Hi, I'm Linda from Little Farmhouse Flowers.
And I'm Emily from Bonchop Flowers.
And this is the Frost on Flowers podcast, where we dig into the hustle of cool climate cultivation.
Thanks for joining us. We hope you enjoy today's episode.
This is so cool. I'm really excited for this call. So for our guests, we have John and Katie Culpepper here, and they are inventors of sorts. We're going to learn about what they made to produce compost and how they did it and how they're sharing the word with a good word with the world and all this exciting stuff. So Katie works here on our farm at Little Farmhouse Flowers, and she's been helping with seed sowing and transplanting things this spring. And that's kind of how I got sucked into the vortex of this incredible work that they do outside of her time here. So yeah, it's fun to introduce them to you, Em.
Great. I'm really excited to hear more about your invention and the composting that you're doing and how you got into it. I know Linda knows that I plant a lot of my crops into compost that we're composting on our farm, but I'm really curious about what you guys are doing. So I'd love to hear a little bit about the composting unit that you've created, and does it have a name?
Yeah, you know, that's the problem is it doesn't have a name.
So
we're terrible marketers, actually. So composting, as you know, Emily, falls into, you know, sort of backyard, community scale, and commercial or industrial scale. At the community scale, what I'm assuming you're operating at and what the niche that we're in, there is a variety of different composting methods. There's static bay, aerated static bay. There's windrowed piles that you turn with a tractor or some other piece of equipment. And then there's in-vessel, or what's called rotating drum composters. Rotating drum composters are units that are cylindrical. Ours is 4 feet in diameter by 20 feet long, and right, accommodates up to about 50,000 pounds of food waste per year. So we didn't invent in-vessel composting. In fact, we didn't invent anything. We just basically about 6.5, 7 years ago, I thought to myself, I love the idea of in-vessel composting. Those units take up so much less space. They optimize the environmental conditions for the microbes that do the vast majority of the work. And they're just cool. And they require much less equipment and that kind of thing, but they're really expensive. And so in the process of, in my job at North Country School Camp Treetops, I'm the director of facilities and sustainability. Facilities being a huge part of my job and sustainability being a tiny part of my job, but that's where my passion lies with sustainability. I thought, we'll buy one. So I went on the online and looked, and they range anywhere from $40,000 to $200,000 for the size that I wanted.
And I thought, that doesn't sound sustainable.
No, for composting. And I thought, that's nuts. It shouldn't be this expensive. So to make a long story short, I got linked up with a woman by the name of Jen Perry, who is the third member of this team. And she, through her work with the Adirondack North Country Association, they were applying for big grant for the North Country. And she included an idea that I had for that grant, or that grant to fund a variety of projects in the North Country. So the idea was, I think I can come up with a design that can be built for a material cost of $15,000 or less. And so I wrote up a proposal. In fact, I wrote up a variety of proposals. I don't know whether you knew this or not, Katie, but I had like 5 proposals for Anka, and I forget what most of them were, but this one grabbed their attention. And so I made this crazy bold statement that I could design and build a composter for $15,000 in material cost. And the New York State Energy Development and Energy Research and Development Authority, NYSERDA, the state funder that funded this original composter, essentially said, okay, approve it. And so I think they granted at that time maybe $30,000 to design and build the composter. And so I got together with a friend of mine who is a contractor who does a lot of work on our campus, a fellow by the name of Greg LeClaire, a brilliant guy who is in the excavating business, but has a real mind for mechanical stuff. And so he and I got together, and well, originally I got together with an engineer friend of mine. He's not an engineer, he's a material scientist friend of mine who teaches out in one of the Midwestern colleges. And he came up with this crazy complicated design that then Greg and I said, we can make that simpler and therefore less expensive. And so through an iterative process, we did that. We kept coming up with ideas and modifying those ideas. And Greg took those ideas and built this composter in his shop. Without any real understanding of the dynamics, the engineering variables involved, it turns out we got all of the design components pretty much spot on. And he built the thing. We put that in operation on our campus at North Country School Camp Treetops about 5 years ago. And it's been in continuous operation ever since. So from that initial success, with the help of Jen Perry, our third partner, we went back to NYSERDA and asked them for money to build and then gift three more of these composters. And they said, yes. And so Greg built three more. One went to a natural history museum with a wild center in Tupper Lake. One went to a youth center in partnership with the Lake Placid School District. And then one went to another school district up to the north of us near the Canadian border. Those have all been in operation for about two and a half, three years, yep. I guess. And then since then, other people have seen our design, which is an open source design, free and available to anyone in the world. And they have built their own. We have an independent school in New Jersey, the Pingree School, their maintenance department built one. We have one being built right now by a fellow who lives in San Diego, and he's building this in Mexico. What's the town in Mexico?
Ensenada,
Mexico. And he's latched on. He's a producer of vermicompost. And so he's using worms to create a much higher value compost. So he's using our design, scaling it up a little bit, and using food waste as a feedstock for his vermicomposting operation. Fascinating. So that's more than you wanted, I'm sure, but that's sort of the background.
No, that's all really good stuff. It's great hearing all that backstory and all the different components, and then the success and people being so interested in implementing it in all of their different areas. That's wonderful. And the open design piece that's pretty cool and generous. So can you describe to me the mechanic? So I understand it's like a tube, like a culvert tube, right?
Right, exactly right. So it is exactly the same kind of culvert that is used in highway construction. So it's a polyethylene, double-walled, corrugated culvert. And that culvert simply sits on a frame, and on that frame there are two drive axles. And those drive axles, there are eight drive wheels on that drive axle. So long story short, the a switch turns on a motor that turns those drive axles. That then rotates the drum, and the drum is on a slight incline. And so the material that we load in the loading door end gradually works its way to the discharge end. And by the time it gets there, it is stabilized organic material. Not quite compost yet, but well on its way to being compost.
And what is the, you know, are you getting some heat going on in there? Have you measured your temperatures?
So I think we paused there for a moment when you asked me about what sort of temperature is reached inside the drum and what produces that temperature. Well, inside the drum are, and we've calculated within an order of magnitude or so, the number of microbes in this drum. And each one of those microbes are producing a tiny amount of thermal energy. And as it turns out, according to my calculations using the US EPA's data and a research group down in University of Hawaii, there are more microbes in this drum than there are all the grains of sand on planet Earth.
Wow.
And that is 4 × 3 × 10⁻⁶ power, something like that. At any rate, it's a big, big number. And so heat is generated by those microbes, mostly bacteria, but there are a lot of microbes in there. And we measure the temperature by putting a data logger that is designed for deep sea research in. We tie it to a wiffle ball so that we can find it when it comes out, because it's not a very large thing. It's easily lost in the mix. And so when it comes out, we can download the data from that data logger. The data logger takes temperature points every 5 minutes, and we can graph those data, and we can see the raw data. And we know that we reach temperatures as high as 150, sometimes 155 degrees Fahrenheit. Sometimes even a little bit higher than that. And we can sustain temperatures of over 131 degrees Fahrenheit for three consecutive days. That's the US EPA's gold standard for pathogen reduction. So if you can maintain 131 degrees Fahrenheit for three consecutive days, then you've destroyed all the pathogens that the US EPA is worried about that might... human pathogens. And by that point, you've destroyed all weed seeds and every other kind of pathogen that we would worry about in soils.
That sounds awesome. That's what we need, Linda. Get rid of our potential leftover fusarium in our tool crates.
Yeah, we have, you know, fusarium is a big problem for us with cut flower growing, and it comes in on the tulip bulbs. It also afflicts tulips. You know, future tulips, it's not good for them. And it's a big problem, so much as, you know, when farmers are planting the tulips in the ground, they'll only plant them in the same place every 7 years.
Right.
Because they're so, you know, we're so worried about this disease. And then, of course, if it, you know, we worry about it mixing with the other things that we're putting in the compost pile. There's all these different complications, and eventually it leads to a lot of waste in a lot of different ways, because we don't want to reuse any of the soil product or the soilless mix that we've been growing in, if they were in or around the tulips. And
fusarium is just one of many plant pathogens that are out there.
Yeah, there's Pythium. I mean, there's a number of problematic things that, you know, farmers growing any product run into. So that's interesting. So mostly this drum, you're using food waste. Is that primarily what's going in there, or is there anything else that?
Yes. Well, food waste is what this drum was designed for, but you have to mix a carbon bulking material with food waste. And that carbon bulking material can be wood chips. It can be wood shavings like you would see in a horse stall, or it can be wood pellets like you burn in a pellet stove. For the last 3 years, I think we've been using wood pellets, although we've used all three. You can use essentially any kind of dried carbon bulking material If it were pelletized, you could use cardboard, but and so you need that carbon bulking material because the microbes need a certain carbon to nitrogen ratio for them to really thrive. And so as that carbon, so we put in our drum, the recipe, we put in about a quarter of the mass of carbon for every 1 pound of food waste, we put in about a quarter pound of pellets at any rate. When we use other carbon bulking materials, we have to adjust the recipe or the ratio of carbon to nitrogen. But food waste is a high nitrogen content, right. and wood products have a high carbon content. And so if you mix those in the right ratio and then blend those with enough oxygen at the right moisture content, then the microbes just take off and flourish. And so those microbes really want to break down the food waste. We just optimize the environmental conditions, but we've primarily food waste goes through our drum, but you can compost any sort of organic material. On our farm, on our campus, we have a farm and we have chickens and we have turkeys, and they periodically are harvested. And the offal or the stuff that we don't want, the heads, the feathers, the feet, so forth, goes right into the drum. So the drum will take meat products, dairy products, fats, oils, you name it. It eats all that stuff up.
Okay. And are there any other additives that you're putting in aside from the, you know, the wood-based carbon products?
No, it's in a really simple recipe. It's just food waste and carbon. That's all it is. We've experimented with other organic materials as well. Since you can edit this, I'll put this in and you might want to edit it out, but we've developed a recipe for processing human urine through this drum. And and we've processed over 5,000 pounds of human urine, more than two tons of human urine. And it turns out there are a lot of people in the world, a lot of researchers in the world, who are trying to figure out how to upcycle human urine. But no one seems to be sort of taking the simple approach by composting it. So we've developed a recipe that we think is the first of its kind in the world. And we, Katie and I, presented at an international conference virtually not too far back. And we've gotten a lot of interest from a lot of other researchers who are interested in what we're doing. So, as an aside, human urine is something that we work with.
That's fascinating. I mean, there are so many things that it would be nice if there were a way to, you know, like human urine, compost them so that we're, you know, reprocessing things in a way that they're usable and not just, you know, an unusable waste product that's cluttering up.
Well, there's a huge amount of plant food
holding tanks
in human urine, as there is in food waste as well. But human urine is, you know, once it's processed through a wastewater treatment plant, it really, you know, it's still doing damage downstream. It still has pharmaceuticals in it that it had when it went into the wastewater treatment plant. Run that through a high temperature process like composting, and those pharmaceuticals get broken down. So there are a lot of reasons why this might be a good idea. And it's liquid gold. It really is.
Liquid gold. Nice. Okay. So if Linda and I, you know, thinking about us as flower farmers and what we're doing, especially with our tulip crates, how would, you know, obviously our crates, by the end of it, the green matter is pretty much gone. What we're left with is our soil, our bulbs, root matter. Could we put those into this tube, and what would we need to add to make for some really efficient compost there? Would we need to add more green? You know, the food, you're saying the food has lots of nitrogen. Our weight spent crates aren't really heavy on nitrogen, I don't feel like. I mean, maybe a little bit with the bulbs, but what would your thought be on that? How would we compost those efficiently using that method?
The answer to the question, can you compost all of the byproducts of your business? The answer is absolutely yes. Every feedstock, you have to experiment with every feedstock, whether it's through in-vessel composting or any other kind of compost system, you have to figure out the recipe. And so does it need additional carbon? I don't know. May have plenty of carbon already. Does it need to be a little drier than what the moisture content when you are ready to put it in? I don't know. But all of those things can be figured out, and you can create a beautiful product, compost, from the vegetable material that you end up with, leaves and stalks and dead flowers, and the media that you grow those in or force those in. Absolutely.
So this is really interesting from a sustainability standpoint. Obviously, it's a lot more financially sustainable if we can create our own growing medium and compost, which right now, for my firm anyways, we're buying in lots and lots of it, dump trucks of it.
Do you have an estimated cost of what you go through a year?
I can look that up. Yeah. For you, for sure. But we're also looking at, like, you know, the carbon footprint created by those trucks that have to get it here.
Yeah.
And so there's kind of that nasty part of it also. And here, at least, we're still using a lot of peat-based products, which we know is a non-renewable resource. And we'd really like to move away from that. And that's one reason that we're experimenting with hydroponics. But this own-made, you know, really nicely cooked, if you will, compost is so appealing, and it, for so many reasons.
Yeah, I think that's one of the, so from this composter, we, with so much interest from people all over for food waste and other things, we created this project called Compost for Good. And our tagline for that is reimagining waste, because so much that we consider waste is actually a valuable resource. And that's what is really fascinating for me to think about. When thinking about compost, is that right now so much of our waste, our conception of waste creates this really broken system, this linear system that it is not, right? Or shouldn't be. And when you can capture those nutrients, those resources, and keep them on the farm or keep them in the community or whatever the case may be, then all of a sudden you're looking at this loop, this cycle, versus this kind of short term. It's good because it's out of your hair and you don't have to worry about it, but then you're sending off resources and bringing resources back in, and that's silly, right? That's crazy.
So on to be able to create a closed nutrient loop, or mostly closed, is both economical, more environmentally friendly, and has a lot of other benefits as well. So absolutely well said.
I have a question about climate. So I know that the composter that you're talking about at North Country School Camp Treetops, and obviously our farm, Emily's farm, we're all in very cold climates. So when you're talking about the temperature inside the drum, being able to reach those heights, if we're in a warmer climate, is it getting warmer faster? This is maybe a naive question, but I'm just curious, like if someone's building this down south or in Mexico, like you were saying, are they achieving higher temperatures, or is there a point where it's not good? Like it gets too hot?
Yeah, so that's a complicated question. So unpack it a little bit. You can get too hot. And when temperatures get too hot, around 160 degrees, then you get what you really want in a composter is a wide variety of species, microbial species. And so you've got microbes that perform well at one set of temperatures, others that perform well at other sets of temperatures. When you get up too high, then only a certain type of microbe can actually live. And so you see these temperature crashes as a result of reducing species complexity. And so temperatures that are too high aren't great. And since the microbes are what's producing the thermal energy, if you're in a warmer climate, then that material heats up that much faster. Mm. Absolutely. And in a warmer climate, you actually have to take you have to make sure that you're not reaching temperatures that are too high. So you might have to rotate the drum more often, or you might have to water it a little more. You might have to change the recipe a little bit.
Which actually we just talked to a group in Mexico, remember? A different group in Mexico who's working on a different system, but another drum system. And they were talking about how insulated their drum was because they really wanted to reach those temperatures. And we were talking to them and we're like, you're fine. You're not going to have trouble if the conditions are right, won't have trouble reaching those temperatures and may actually need to work to lower, keep them kind of that mid-range where you do have that diversity of species. But
yeah,
it is very different composting here than composting in Mexico for sure.
And that's a fascinating story. 2 years ago, I think this group of researchers got applied for and got $250,000 in grant money to design and build a composter for the university that they work at. It's a Jesuit university in Guadalajara, mm-hmm. I think. And they put a lot of energy, a lot of effort into this composter, came up with this really interesting design. And they went to great lengths to insulate their drum, and it turns out they really didn't need to do that at all. But Katie and I connected with that group of researchers because they wanted to pick our brains about how they could modify their design to make it more efficient for their operation.
Well, and work, because remember we talked to them, that's okay to say, we talked to them the day after they did their first trial turn of the drum. And it didn't turn. It was variety of reasons. We just happened to catch them the day after 2 years. And you shushed me, so maybe I shouldn't have said they were very, they took it in stride and it was all, you know, they're creating the system that they had never seen before. And so they were, still hopeful and excited and energetic and asking lots of questions.
Figured it out.
Well, that wasn't too long ago.
Well, no, we haven't figured it out yet.
But they will.
Podcasts can be accessed by a variety of people, we wouldn't want those folks to be to hear that they
you think they would mind that?
But interesting, they came up with a completely different design, and so these in-vessel composters, we don't have the perfect design by any means. We've got a baseline design that that other people can modify to fit their needs, to make the drum larger for greater capacity, whatever their needs are.
And that was part of the design, was to make it simple enough that people could take it and make modifications to better fit the needs of their particular location or the kind of institution or whatever it is, and why the plans are all free and available, because the dream is that the word gets out and people start building these, or people start making them even more efficient or more affordable or more adaptable or whatever. But the idea is just more compost, not that we have a design that we're trying to sell by any means.
Exactly.
Right.
Yeah, that's awesome. Amazing. And so you were saying, I mean, at the beginning, you said you started off with a budget of $15,000 and then you threw out some other numbers. So if I were to try to go out and build one, you know, tomorrow, how much would I be looking to invest?
If you could build in
my supplies?
Sure. Yeah. It's a great question. If you had the capacity to build it yourself, then you can build it with $15,000 or less in material cost. What your laborer is, you know, whatever your labor is. If you were to say, John, Katie, can you have one built and sent our way? We can do that. We can work with Greg, who built these other four. You're looking at maybe $35,000 in to build, deliver, and set up that compost or something like that. But we're not in the business of selling anything. So if someone wanted Greg's contact information, we happily provide it. He would love to make, he'd love to do nothing but make composters. That's, he really enjoyed that.
And now we're going to take a quick break for a message from our sponsor. This episode is brought to you by our sister project or side hustle. Emily and I have been teaching students from across the country and around the world now how to force tulips and to schedule a program that will bring in significant income for their flower farming businesses during the off season. If you're interested, please visit www.bondtrapflowers.shop and fill out our online inquiry form to learn about upcoming opportunities and our new filmed workshop, an online program that will be released in early 2022.
What does the entrance point look like for the composter? Like, are you able to like drive up there with a tractor bucket and dump into it, or how does that work, Katie?
That's a good question too. So the one that at actually all of the ones in operation right now, the answer to that question is no. Right now it's a little door that you open and you can dump buckets into. And part of the reason for the design that we currently have is that the first one went to North Country School and Camp Treetops, and the idea was that it wanted to be kind of on a child scale, or at least where children can be interacting with it. And they're doing all the work. I'm sure your children have interacted with it. So the idea was to make it really hands-on and make it very manual. We believe that a lot of it could be automated, and some people are doing work to figure out how to make it more automated. We have talked about what it would look like to have a kind of hopper where you could dump from a tractor bucket into a hopper, and then that would be loaded in. So that's something we would love to see, maybe at, with another grant work that we do, to create a system like that, or to have someone else take a look at the design and say, hey, I could do this, but I would love to have it look like that because my operation doesn't work to have hand bucket dumping, but it would really work if I was able to approach it with a tractor. So it's adaptable. We would love to see a tractor loaded system. But it's not quite yet.
Yeah, we're actively pursuing grants that would allow us to design a larger composter and with a hopper. As it turns out, the difference in capacity between 4 foot diameter and 5 foot diameter, you can get over 1.5 times the amount of volume in a 5 foot diameter drum than you can a 4 foot diameter drum. And so, if we can process 50,000 pounds of food waste plus another 25,000 pounds of carbon in our design, then a 5 foot diameter, 20 foot long drum could process over 75,000 pounds of food waste, and then another X number of thousand pounds of carbon.
And the time from when, is it pretty consistent? Like the time you put, say, the food waste in to when it comes out, is that timeline kind of consistent and universal depending on what time of year it is, and what exactly, how much time goes by until you're getting that material out the other end?
So it turns out that question is a little more complicated than one might think. It could be consistent if you were loading exactly the same amount in every day. But the goal is to create, the goal is to have the drum half full all the time. Not more than half full, not less than half full, but half full. That gives you enough capacity in there to tumble the material when the drum rotates. And so the less material you put in, the less material comes out. And so the one at North Country School, the shortest, what we call retention time, or the amount of time between the loading door end and the discharge door, discharge tube end. The shortest amount of time was 18 days, I think, and the longest time, well, we've had during COVID, we've had some really long retention times, up to 2.5-3 months, perhaps, because just not very much was being loaded on a daily basis. So it all depends.
Right. Pretty good turnaround when it's active. The 18 days, that seems quick.
That is quick, right. And again, what comes out the end is it's stabilized. It doesn't draw flies or rodents or dogs or bears or whatever. But it still needs to sit and go through more decomposition. Particularly important is what we call secondary decomposition, or decomposition at lower temperatures. That's where more complex communities of organisms gets in there. Fungal colonies will get in there. Fungal organisms will get in there. And that really, that's where the real magic happens. That's when these large organic molecules get turned into humic acids and fulmic acids, and those small molecular weight carbon compounds that will persist in soils for decades. That's where the real magic is. And so there's great benefit by putting the material that comes right out of the drum. Katie, when she was farm manager at North Country School, she would take the material that came right out of the drum, and then she would use that as top dressing. But if you can let it sit for another month or so, you can create real magic with this material and create compounds that do really incredible things for water holding retention of soils, of nutrient holding retention. It really stimulates the life in soils. So, you know, this is a way to take dirt and turn it into real soil. Soil is a living, breathing thing. Dirt is just minerals, water, and air. And the real magic happens when you stimulate the soils to create more microbial life, and especially the fungal of hyphae. There's just so much information coming out these days on the benefit of mycorrhizal fungi when it comes to plant nutrient uptake, plant water uptake, communication, plant disease resistance. It's really quite amazing.
That's awesome.
So I'm looking at all these stalks right here, and I'm thinking, perfect that material.
I have a whole bunch of a pile of tulip stems.
Oh yeah, I just dumped bucket loads of leaf and stem debris. I actually almost took a picture of it just because it was so massive, because I'm processing so many flowers right now. But yeah, the other thing is like sunflower stalks at the end of the season. I have so many of those that are really nice and fibrous and woody and would be great in that composter.
Yeah, they would probably need to be cut up some. You probably add them to are you doing windrowed composting at your farm, Emily?
We have piles. We've got some piles on our farm, and with stuff like what I actually do mostly with my sunflowers is I mow them. So they get chopped up and just they decompose kind of as a mulch on top. And we haven't gone to no-till yet. So oftentimes then they're getting tilled in for the next season.
Sure. So if people want to, on their own, reach out to you or find more information about your project, where do they go?
Yeah, so Compost for Good is now the kind of spot to find all of that. We have a website on the 80K Action. We are a project of 80K Action. So on the 80K Action website, you can find Compost for Good. And we have a Facebook page that is emerging. We're learning how to do social media.
slowly for old timers like me.
Yeah, but on both the Facebook and on our website, you can find email addresses, and we would love to hear from anyone who's interested in composting with this compost design or just compost in general. We're excited to talk to anyone who's looking to do better with their waste.
Yeah, it turns out if you just simply search Compost for Good, you'll pull up a bunch of information on our initiative, blog posts or website or Facebook, links to articles, links to presentations we've done. Pretty easy to find us. And we would love to connect with anyone out there in the podcast world who is interested in reimagining their wastes.
Have you? So for me, I have this dream. I've seen some people doing, you know, compost and incorporating tubing for water to heat their water systems. And when Linda and I were over in Holland, most of the greenhouses there are heated with water systems. So it's hot water going through tubing. And so like the ultimate dream for me is to create a compost pile that's generating the heat to heat the water, to then bring the water into the greenhouse to heat the space. And have you guys ever thought about, I imagine it would be hard to incorporate running water through a turning culvert like that, but is that something that's ever come onto your radar? Using that heat?
Sure, lots of times.
Yeah.
And you're right, Emily, it's difficult to capture thermal energy in a system like an in-vessel system. But people all over the world are doing this and have been doing this for decades. And you can do it with nothing more than finely ground up wood chips. A lot of people interested in permaculture have experimented with hot water systems using either compost or just decomposing wood chips. As it turns out, if you put enough wood chips in the right conditions in a big pile, that pile will heat up and it will get up to 150 degrees. And if you have tubing running through there and then water moving through the tubing, you can transfer that thermal energy and you can do a lot of, you can heat spaces with it, greenhouses, bed systems, benches, you name it. It's a great thing to think about. But in an in-vessel system, it's difficult to capture that thermal energy for sure.
So excited. I can't wait to do a little more research and see your images and stuff.
Well, you're not too far away. We'd love to host you and we could show you one of our composters on this side of the lake.
Yeah, that would be fun. I get over there every once in a while to see Linda. So I'd love
And
to
Linda may have one cool. of her own one of these days. Who knows?
That'd be cool. So what about, you know, are there any resources for people listening if they wanted to try, like, where would they go to try to find grant funding potentially to get one of your composters on their own farm? Is that information you guys have?
We are working under a grant right now through the Pollution Prevention Institute. It's a New York State grant. And through that grant, we're assembling information that can lead people to where they might be able to access capital, whether it's in the form of grants or low interest loans or whatever. But especially if you're in a state where they're trying to kickstart composting, like New York State, New York State's gonna pump a lot of money into this over the next several years. And our goal is to get to where you are in Vermont. Vermont did this at the state level many years ago. They said to themselves, we're going to get to the point where no food scraps are going into the landfill. And so it was just this past summer, I believe, that even at the residential level, you can no longer put food scraps in the trash. Well, Vermont no doubt had state programs that helped people develop systems like this. New York is an emerging state in the world of composting. So there are probably more grant resources here, but it just depends on your location. There are a lot of grants out there from the state, federal, local levels. There are a lot of people who want to support this kind of work.
And just since you mentioned it, in New York, the legislation is coming down January 1st, 2022.
Is that 2022, correct?
Yep. I'm confused about what year it is.
Less than 12 months.
Yep. The first round of legislation is being rolled out, and that will only impact the largest producers of food waste, and only if they're within 25 miles of a composter or a composting facility. So it's not going to affect a whole lot of people to start, but it is the first step. And so we're really trying to, with our project, we're really trying to get the word out there so that people can start getting into the realm of composting, because there will be very soon more legislation coming that will get more stringent, just like in Vermont, right? They started with very kind of broad, large laws, and then it came down, closer to,
the residential level.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the local level.
At least that's our hope. Mm-hmm. And I think that's probably reasonable to assume.
That... Well, in our conversations with the DEC, who are the right, it's the DEC who
regulates composting,
regulating this. They do not have a schedule of when it's coming out. I think Vermont did. They published right when they started it. They published that as of this date it will be here, and all the other dates. Right now in New York we only have that first date, but that's a sign that things are coming. And there is funding through the Pollution Prevention Institute, which you just talked about, specifically for people who are trying to start up composting businesses or increase their composting businesses. There are existing funds available, and we're trying to stay on top of other funds that come around. And we're posting those on our webpage as we come across them.
USDA is a good source. SARE that operates under SARE that operates under USDA is a good source. But there are a lot of potential sources, and there are community members potentially within your region, your area, that you could crowdsource from or get interested in donations. There are a lot of people have an interest in this.
Thank you guys so much. Yeah.
Yeah, it's been great. Really appreciate it.
Thanks again for listening, and be sure to share your questions and ideas for future episodes. You can reach us at frostonflowerspodcast@gmail.com. This podcast is produced and edited by Brad DiArco. We're so grateful for his help. We'll catch you next time for another cool episode of the Frost on Flowers podcast.